Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
After World War II, there was an explosion of suburban development. People left the cities looking for a single home, a yard, a garage for the car, and a roadway system that gave them mobility. Now, several generations later, there's a new trend driven by the high cost of energy, concerns about health and the environment, and frustration with traffic jams and highway congestion. This phenomenon is called urbanism or walkable urbanism. The basic concept is built around the idea that Americans want to live in a place where work and shopping and community, culture, and entertainment are close by. Well, today on Radio Times, we're exploring this phenomenon with our guests, Jeannie Birch and Chris Leinberger, and let me introduce them to you. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Jeannie Birch. She's the Lawrence Nussdorf Professor of Urban Research and co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research, chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning in the School of Design at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the editor of a new book called The Urban and Regional Planning Reader, and she's got a book coming out later this year, Growing Greener Cities. And Jeannie Birch, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Chris Leinberger is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington and is director of the Graduate Real Estate Program at the University of Michigan. Also a founding partner of Arcadia Land Company, located here in the Delaware Valley. And he's author of this new book called The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. And he joins us from the Brookings Institution. Chris Leinberger, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me get your definition of urbanism or walkable urbanism as you write about in your book.
Well, you pretty much said it, that it's a walkable place that most of daily needs can be met by walking. And walking is, most of us want to walk about 1,500 to 3,000 feet. And so when you go back to your high school geometry and your pi r squared,
I'm doing it now.
That's somewhere around 100 to 500 acres in size. And that's pretty much defines Center City around City Hall, pretty much defines Society Hill. And obviously not everybody lives there that comes there, so also having rail transit is a very important element to walkable urbanism.
And I'll pick up on all of that, but let me get you, Jeannie Birch, in on the conversation as well. And looking, I guess, at the last 50, 60 years of development where people were leaving cities to move to the suburbs, there were developments that were built, there were highways that were built. What happened to that development? I mean, that whole concept of moving out of the city, getting that little plot of land, getting that little single house, and raising a family.
Well, we have to remember that that was a revolutionary concept when it emerged, that people did not have affordable housing with land around it and nice green grass and so forth. And this was a time in the 50s and 60s when people were having large families. And what's happened now today is our family structure has changed rather radically. Mom, dad, two kids, and the dog is maybe, make up maybe 25, 28% of all of our households.
Wow.
So we now know that we have a larger universe of people who are interested in perhaps a different lifestyle and a different life form. Also, some of the families that I've just described want to live in urban areas as well. They see great advantages to being able to let their children walk to school and other facilities.
Well, you know, I have to say, and this is looking around the suburbs of Philadelphia, I mean, you see gigantic houses going up, a set off on, you know, long roadways and mega developments. And as much as people might be hankering to get out of their cars and walk, you don't see all the evidence of that. I'm looking at you, Jeannie, but Chris, I want to hear from you as well.
We don't see the evidence of the walkable urbanism that you're talking about?
Yes. I mean, I see it in little bits and
right.
pieces, but mainly what I see are big developments going up.
I think we have to look to the finance industry. We have to look at local government, what local government is saying in terms of what they want. Chris, you've been very involved in trying to convince local government to make changes in their zoning, right?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Chris.
That basically what's referred to as drivable suburban development in most jurisdictions is the only thing that's legal, and it's very low density, and it's mandated by law. And if you attempt to do a walkable urban much higher density project, It's illegal. So that's a bit of a problem. And then, as Jeannie mentioned, that the financing of this is very difficult. Wall Street now controls the financing of the real estate business. And it's, of course, highly ironic that the Wall Street investment bankers who live in some of the best walkable urbanism have a hard time financing it. But that's how it's working these days, though they're beginning to learn. And it all goes back to what Jeannie has said, is that the market has shifted. And the market always gets what it wants eventually, in spite of these institutional barriers. But there's some significant institutional barriers, and to a certain extent, it's our de facto domestic policy to subsidize and to promote drivable suburban.
But just picking up on that, then is it the responsibility of local government or the federal government or Wall Street to begin to look at these laws or regulations to try to open up this new urbanism? I'm back to you, Chris Lineberger.
The answer is yes, all of the above. And it's, though in this country, land use issues are controlled at the local level. Mm-hmm. So it starts with local townships, local counties, local cities, allowing what the market wants to be developed. And you're, of course, in Philadelphia seeing a lot of those battles, around the Ardmore train station, a massive battle as far as allowing higher density development to take place there. So. And this battle's mainly going to take place in the suburbs, by the way.
Well, and going to some of those local zoning meetings, they can be very contentious. Do you know? Looking at you, Gina.
Well, Vital Brzezinski has just written a book on this, on an effort that was tried in the suburbs here in New Daleville, which has been built. But I think we have to be a little careful about oversimplifying and blaming people. We have to realize, too, that there's an affordability piece to this as well. If you were to compare what you could get in one of those McMansions with what you could get in buying an urban piece of real estate, I think you'd find some the favor going in terms of space to the larger unit in the greenfield. And so we have a consumer issue as well. It's expensive to build. I'm not talking suburban as you are, Chris, but I'm talking about as people trade off between living in a city and living in the suburbs and living in places where it's already walkable versus places that aren't walkable. It's certainly the cost factors and what you get for your dollar are very important to the consumers.
And I wanted to you, though, Chris, just to make sure our audience understands, in certain ways we're talking about, let's say, downtown or center city Philadelphia. I'm assuming we're also talking about these town centers, these communities that have been built with all these features in mind. But I'm assuming we're also talking about good old-fashioned towns. Are we not, Chris?
Absolutely. No, we're seeing this emerge. And a survey that I just released here at Brookings last month focused on the walkable urban places in the top 30 metros. And surprisingly, 50% of them were in center cities, but therefore 50% of them were in the suburbs. And many of the suburban towns that were 18th, 19th century towns that were by definition developed before the car are finding that they are ground zero for walkable urban development. So, a Bethesda outside of Washington and Evanston north of Chicago and Pasadena in Southern California are places that have seen incredible amounts of growth because they've got great bones that they can build around.
Well, the Bethesda case is really interesting, Chris, don't you think, because of the impact of the metro. And the investment that D.C. made, or I guess we all made.
Yes, we did.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Create that kind of transportation so that you have that whole Bethesda Center is just absolutely remarkable. I was just there yesterday speaking with someone around Wisconsin Avenue where they're upgrading the station there, and they built some office mixed-use buildings, but even there in Chevy Chase, they were finding resistance to anything taller than 13 stories. And
exactly.
So the density, the intensity question is still very much out there in terms of the education we need to do and the politics of the whole situation.
And just picking up on that, Chris, you say public transit is key to this urbanism that we're talking about.
Yes. Rail transit in particular seems to have a really high correlation with these walkable urban places. Of the 157 places I surveyed, in the 30 top metros in the country, two-thirds of them were rail-served. And it just obviously gets far more people there than would be getting there if they just had to rely upon the car. And it builds. The thing about these walkable urban places is that as you add more density, they just get better. It's what I refer to as more is better.
Yeah.
That the number of people on the street, the vibrancy, the number, you know, the number of restaurants, the retail, the housing, the office, the hotels, it all just spirals upward. In contrast, drivable suburban, which is a option for the market that, you know, a lot of people want, a lot of people will want in the future. We've just overbuilt it, by the way, a little bit. But the drivable suburban, as you add more, you get less quality of life. You get more traffic congestion. You get less open space. You get more pollution. And so much of the opposition to walkable urban development is because people that are fighting it, they learn the lessons of the last war, which is as you build more suburban sprawl, it gets worse. Well, as you build more walkable urbanism, as long as it's managed and it's contained,
that and it's beautiful.
And it's beautiful, well-designed, you get better quality of life, and the people that live around it have the best of two worlds. They have suburban splendor, and they get to walk to great urbanism.
I'm looking at you, Jeannie Birch. Are we then talking about upscale people? I mean, are we talking essentially about designing communities for people that have money and education? I know that you've looked at Center City, Philadelphia, who's moving there, who's living there.
Right. In fact, I did a study of 45 downtowns to see who was moving and living there and so forth. And to date, most of the efforts, of course, have been for those who can pay for it. The affordable housing issue has not been a downtown housing issue per se. Doesn't mean it can't be.
Right.
We have plenty of devices to find ways to create affordable housing, and we should incorporate that in how we're thinking about these things.
And looking at Philadelphia and some of these other center cities that you looked at, or downtown cities, are they pretty much the same in that you've got young, I guess, professionals looking to enjoy the city life and perhaps, you know, aging baby boomers?
Right, you've got the profile.
Is that it?
It's the young people and the empty nesters who are definitely doing this. But a new movement we are seeing is families. And it's families so long as there are options for education and it's safe. And Philadelphia has been doing a number of things to make those options reality.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's much more to talk about, but I do need to take a very short break. I also want to give out that phone number and find out what you, our listeners, think about what we're talking about. It's pedestrian-friendly urban planning. It has a number of different names, walkable urbanism or urbanism. Christopher Leinberger is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, also director of the graduate real estate program at the University of Michigan, and he's a founding partner of Arcadia Land Company, and he's the author of a new book. It's called The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. Jeannie Birch is the Lawrence Dustorf Professor of Urban Research and co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research and chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning in the School of Design at the University of Pennsylvania. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. February 2nd through April 13th, Cecilia Beau, American figure painter. Beau was a trailblazing woman artist who achieved international acclaim painting portraits of prominent figures from the post-Civil War to post-World War I periods. On display, 100 works by Cecilia Beau, Academy alumna, professor, and Philadelphia native. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org.
On February 5th, more than 20 states will hold presidential primaries and caucuses. The results could determine the major party's nominees, or they could propel the battle for convention delegates into the later contests. NPR will bring you live coverage of the returns, plus candidate speeches, reports from key states, and expert analysis. Join us for Super Tuesday 2008 from NPR News.
Tuesday, February 5th at 8 p.m. on WHYY.
Is there a cure for soils composed of clay? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what you can do when your dirt is more suited to making pots than growing plants. Plus, chemical-free answers to all of your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For the past 50 or 60 years, American cities have been designed with cars in mind, and certainly the suburbs developed that way. But what if planners made people the top priority, where walkability was the number one priority? And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with our guests, Christopher Leinberger and Jeannie Birch. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Chris, I'm just curious, we're having this conversation while there's all this nervousness on Wall Street about the subprime mortgage market, and you know, people are not able to sell houses as quickly as they hoped, and prices are dropping. Does what we're talking about, is that a solution to the problem that we're seeing with Wall Street and mortgage meltdown?
Funny you should ask about that. I have a piece coming out in the Atlantic Monthly in a few weeks that discusses just this very issue.
Oh,
and
really?
That the subprime mortgage meltdown is probably a precursor to something that is much more structural. Just as we've been talking about, there's a structural shift in what the market wants, and more people want walkable urban. And one of the reasons, by the way, that the prices are so high is because we don't have enough supply. It's a supply side problem, and so it's driving prices up. But there's the issue of what to do with the overbuilt large lot single family out on the fringe. And one estimate is over the next 20 years, upwards of a third of those large lot houses are going to have a hard time finding buyers.
Really?
And that means price declines on the fringe that is really only comparable to what happened the last time we had a structural shift back in the 50s and 60s, as we all wanted to move out to the suburbs. And center cities collapsed as far as their housing prices. So the subprime is sort of is potentially a peek into the future of what could happen to places on the fringe that are no longer what the market wants.
Well, I'm looking at you, Jeannie. What then happens?
But maybe there's a silver lining in this, Chris. Maybe municipalities being faced with these probably abandoned or low-cost now housing that's underpriced may have to think of ways to restructure the arrangements around these housing units. I mean, I would think they'd have to come up with some pretty creative ideas to make this to make the move.
Well, certainly there's going to be a lot of suburban town centers developed. I mean, in Philadelphia right now, that if you developed at the same way that the Washington, D.C. area has developed, which is based upon the survey that we've been talking about, is the model of where the country's going as far as walkable urbanism, that Philadelphia should have another 15 walkable urban places that are comparable to Center City in the region.
So when you talk about the town centers, those are usually retail, correct?
Well, it includes retail.
Yes, and how I think one of the big issues that we've seen a number of these models elsewhere where it's been mainly retail, they've tried to put a little housing in it, but there's been, again, some resistance because of our long love affair with single-use zoning.
Exactly.
So being able to show that the mixed use works and is exciting and marketable, I think, is the challenge of the next couple of decades.
And let me just to make sure that our listeners understand, then, when you're talking about a town center, Chris, and so it is the idea of this urbanism that we've been talking about, but this mixed use, obviously needing to look at the zoning, but the idea that everything anyone wants is pretty much within walking or public transit distance?
Exactly. And so, for instance, Reston Town Center is sort of the granddaddy of the suburban built from scratch.
You should take some credit there, Chris.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I've just been around long enough. You've seen all this stuff.
And you have to know that Chris was the originator of the thinking behind this, and he put the numbers together to make it happen.
And this is what we're talking about, right?
Yes, yes. Sorry to interrupt.
Well,
I just
want
to make sure you got the due credit.
Well, there's a lot of folks involved with Reston Town Center, and it's kind of ironic that Mobil Oil was the owner of Reston at the time that they built this 20 years ago. But Reston Town Center has developed into a high-density, walkable urban place. It does not have rail transit yet. It will get rail transit over the next 5 to 7 years. And it has housing and retail and office and hotel, bike trails, and it's much beloved in Fairfax County. It's really their downtown.
And well, let me just ask, though, I mean, taking that idea and even looking at the Philadelphia area, are you saying that you could recreate a bunch of Restons or mini Restons in this region, Chris?
Absolutely. Again, if the market gets what it wants, as I say, you've got about five regionally significant walkable urban places now. And if you follow the same path that the Washington, D.C. metro is, which is about the same size, you would have another 15 or more. And most of those are going to go in the suburbs, not in Center City.
Hey, Chris, let's think about King of Prussia.
Absolutely.
Well, I was wondering about
what
King of Prussia.
What would you do with King of Prussia?
You know, I got to tell you, I grew up in the Philadelphia area.
This is a big test, too, isn't it?
Well, I grew up in the Philadelphia metro area, and I used to take the subway downtown to where my father worked there at Penn Center. He was, by the way, the first tenant in Penn Center back in 1955. And but my mother would also drive me out to the King of Prussia Mall after it first opened, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so, you know, it's we all fell in love with drivable suburban development. And out in King of Prussia, there exists a great opportunity for high-density development to take place, and in particular in the parking lots around King of Prussia Mall.
Absolutely.
That's the greatest
people
resource
would want to live
they've
there.
Got. Oh. They would love to live
sure.
there.
Sure. Think of what's happening to our population. I mean, here we are at a certain age. We're going to get older. There are going to be a lot more of us. Apparently, every 8 seconds, someone turns 60. At any rate, so here we have.
Coming on.
Boom, boom,
yes.
boom. There's going to be a wonderful market for people who are going to be looking for accessibility to the things that places like King of Prussia offer. Shopping, restaurants, movies, entertainment. It's a natural. Now, there's a scholar at the University of Washington, Anna Vernez Moudon, who has done a tremendous amount of work on this, showing how you can take Kings of Prussia and also smaller shopping centers and redesign them to achieve these goals that we're talking about.
Let me get to our callers, but one question for you, Chris, as someone just typed into me. Would you say that Manhattan is a model for walkable urbanism?
It is an extreme model, and certainly Manhattan, and Manhattan's comprised of about 10 different walkable urban places. Midtown's just one of 10 on Manhattan Island. It's undoubtedly the most dense, of course.
Right.
And by the way, it's important to note, we've not mentioned this yet, but Manhattan and the people that live there use half the energy per capita that the rest of the country does. It is the most environmentally sustainable place in the country. And given that, that the built environment generates over 70% of CO2 emissions, this is a major climate change issue to let the market have what it wants in creating walkable urbanism, because obviously they aren't using that many cars. They're walking to work, they're using trains, and they unintentionally share their heat with their upstairs neighbor.
Well, and Jeannie, you're one of those.
I used
Manhattan.
To be one of those, exactly.
So you
used
know
to
what
be
he's talking about.
Before I came to Penn that I really resented having to leave an area that was basically 10 square blocks. My children went to school there. I could do my shopping for groceries there. Well, my husband had to get to work, but a few blocks away. But nonetheless, my whole daily life was in this very small area. Now that I'm at Penn, what is clearly needed is being able to connect these wonderful walkable places. Amtrak, with its new high-speed rail, of course, is one step in that direction. Mm-hmm. But we need to be thinking not only about these local walkable places, but how we connect that system of walkable places throughout our regions.
And just to pick up on that, because you mentioned that to me during the break, the idea that you can build a lovely sort of totally sort of self-sustaining community out in the country, but if it's not connected to something, have you really solved the problem?
Well, the thing is that you can make it transit-ready. Again, Reston right. Town Center was a green field 20 years ago, and today it has about 8 million square feet and thousands of people living there, and it's all car-served. They have some buses, but it's really 90% of people get there, 95% mm-hmm. get there by car. But it's now transit ready, and 5 to 7 years from now, it'll be linked into the metro system. So eventually, 30-40% of the people going to Reston will be either walking or using metro.
It's expensive, though, is it not? Do you need to put in any kind of metro service or to add on to a metro service?
Well,
if you're laying rails or building...
Of course it's expensive, but what have we spent on our highway system? We've put those kinds of investments into subsidizing and creating a highway system that has created the land patterns we know. It's time to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to make these investments in... particularly our rail system. This is a huge issue. Do you know how many flights we have between New York and Philadelphia?
Mm.
I mean, it's absolutely obscene that we are not putting our investments where we should to rationalize how we move about our region.
And the idea that you can take a train, it's an hour and a half or so between Philadelphia and New York.
It's an hour and 7 minutes.
It's an hour and 7 minutes. On the
a woman who knows.
Yes, she does. Chris, go ahead, and then we'll get to our callers.
Let me mention, this is really an economic... I mean, it's obviously an environmental question, obviously what the market wants, but it's also an economic development issue that numbers show that between 30-40% want 30-40% of our households want walkable urbanism. Mm. In the Philadelphia area, probably no more than 10% of your housing fits that category, and I think that's being rather liberal. You've got this pent-up demand for it, which drives the prices up, but also it means that people who are demanding it are going to go someplace else to get it, and particularly the young people. People in their 20s and 30s today, surveys show that they pick a city that they want to live in first and then figure out what their career is. So if you want the young people, either your kids to stay in Philadelphia or attract the new entrepreneurial types who tend to be in their 20s and 30s, if you're not offering this option, you might as well write off the future of the region economically.
Well, we're talking about pedestrian-friendly planning, and that's Christopher Lineberger. He's got a new book. It's called The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. Also with us, Jeannie Birch, and she's co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research, chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania. A full bank of calls here, so let's see what our listeners have to say, including Robert from Newtown. Robert, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi. I was just wanted to make a comment about, like you said, the connection of places.
Mm-hmm.
Like Newtown in Bucks County is a perfect example. It already has a rail line in place that would connect it to such places as Willow Grove, Southampton, and Philadelphia. I know, like, is it the government or was it SEPTA that stopped that line? And, like, how do people go about trying to bring that back,
sure.
bring something like that back? I know the resistance could be there from Newtown itself because of either fear of what would, you know, come in from Philadelphia or, you know, any other kind of resistance. But like I said, it would be, it's just an amazing thing. That would really give the connection of places that you're talking about.
Well, Robert, let me take that point. I'll toss it over to you, Jeannie Birch.
Well, you put your finger on all the complications that revolve around making transportation investment decisions. There are local political concerns. There are national and state issues about how you distribute your resources and where you put the investment there. And the big question about can you put an investment in when there isn't a right now a demand, but we know if you do make that investment, there mm-hmm. will be demand, but there are all sorts of market studies that might affect how a decision is made, and particularly in a state and a place with scarce resources.
The thing is, of course, is that with the existing rail line in place and converting that into a commuter rail system, it's actually pretty cheap.
Hmm.
And that's happened throughout the country within a year or two of the first, the idea being floated and then having it up and running. Los Angeles did this, and Albuquerque's done this, and it's very easy and reasonably cheap to do. The issue is what the caller has brought up is the concerns that it's a two-way street, and Newtown just has to figure out that, you know, does it want to participate in the 21st century economy or not? But I'll just point out that Georgetown here in D.C., back in the 70s, which was a very racially divided time, of course, in this country, Georgetown decided not to take Metro. And today they rue that decision because it's traffic congested and they don't have any relief, because the only way to get to Georgetown is by car, or obviously there's some buses. And that if you want to be part of the 21st century, you got to have that rail line reactivated.
Robert, thanks for the call. Let me get Clark from Kennett Square to join us. Hi, Clark. Go ahead, your radio times.
Hi. Listen, I'm on the front lines of this thing. I'm the chairman of our planning commission in the borough of Kennett Square.
In the borough of Kennett Square. Well, good welcome luck. To Radio Times, Clark. Go ahead.
Give me some advice. We're doing pretty good. We've really moved ahead in the past 15 or 20 years. And but what do you see as being the two or three key elements that kind of help a municipality reach the tipping point when it comes to promoting these types of issues in their plan?
What's your zoning ordinance look like?
Well, it's kind of a pretty standard, you know, ordinance. We've diddled and played around with it, but it's an accretion like most small municipal ordinances that's just grown over the years.
Mm-hmm. And things added on to that. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Let me mention, because I've done this myself, in downtown Albuquerque, I was doing a redevelopment of the downtown, and we had the same issue with the zoning, and we just threw it out and put in place what's known as a overlay zoning district. Mm. And it basically, you wipe the board clean and put in place a zoning orientation that allows for high-density mixed-use development. But it's important to define the downtown physically and then protect the single-family housing or open space that is outside that. And again, we're only talking, probably there at Kennett Square, you're probably only talking about 100 acres, and you just focus that high-density development in that 100 acres and protect everybody else outside of it. And form-based code is another term for this overlay zoning.
Well, you know, and you make it sound so easy, Chris, but I've been to zoning meetings. Maybe there's something unique about Philadelphia, or Pennsylvania.
No.
Nothing seems to change. There are studies, and then there are studies of studies, and then there are debates about the studies, and then the studies get shelved, and it seems as if, I'm looking actually at you, Jeannie, but go ahead.
Well, being the head of the Planning Commission is more than just dealing with the zoning. There's a whole political dimension to this. And so there are advocacy groups in communities that need to be rallied around the need for change. You need to have the political support to do this. There's no question about it. There are lots of ways to build that political support. You can't do it alone, but if there are obviously like-minded people in your community, or you can have educational programs, you can bring people in to show what it looks like. You can take decision makers or key leaders on field trips to show them that this isn't quite so bad as they might think. Mm. It's a huge educational problem that we're facing here as we try to make these changes.
But and the thing is that people want to see those examples locally, and so it's a catch-22 that nobody's willing to move forward, and therefore there are no local examples. But down here in the D.C. area, there are 20 of these places that are, you know, there's downtown D.C., there's DuPont, there's Bethesda, there's Reston Town Center. And at this point, most of the places out there, most of the places that don't have walkable urbanism, come to a downtown Bethesda and say, why can't we have something like that? Because it's fabulous for all concerned.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, both with our guests and also with our callers, a full bank of calls, talking about pedestrian-friendly planning. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Symphony in C, formerly the Haddonfield Symphony, and music director Rossin Milanov present Nightly Tales, Saturday, February 9th at 8 p.m. at the Gordon Theater on the Rutgers Camden campus. The symphony will perform Strauss's classic Don Quixote and Dvorak's melodic Symphony No. 6. For tickets, 856-429-1880 or on the web at symphonync.org. Symphony in C proudly supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
I am so scared. The police didn't help me.
Domestic abuse is rising in the immigrant community, and often the victims have nowhere to go.
They call the police for help, and 911 hangs up because they don't speak the language.
Some cities are finding ways to make a connection.
Welcome to Language Line Services.
For Spanish, press
giving immigrant victims of crime a stronger voice.
Please press 2.
Next time. on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's next after the Florida primary? It's on to Super Tuesday. Also, Olivier Messiaen, organist, composer, and ornithologist? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on the show, we're talking about urbanism or workable urbanism, the idea that Americans want to live in a place where they can work close by and shop in the neighborhood and have community and culture and entertainment and public transit. And that's what we're talking about with our guest. Christopher Leinberger is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. That's in Washington. Also director of the Graduate Real Estate Program at the University of Michigan and a founding partner of Arcadia Land. Company, author of a new book called The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. Jeannie Birch is the Lawrence Nussdorf Professor of Urban Research, also co-directs the Penn Institute for Urban Research and chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania. And she's got a book coming out later this year called Growing Greener Cities, coming out sometime this summer. Let me see what John from Philadelphia has to say. John, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, thanks.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering, Professor Birch mentioned affordability in passing, and that seems to be the one element that's been lacking so far in the conversation. I'm just wondering on your perspectives about some of the devices, so-called devices, that cities are using to best incorporate the affordability element into urbanist development, because I fear at its end game that we'll only replace a suburban sprawl with an inner-ring suburb of poverty that surrounds these urban enclaves, and what's your thought on that?
No, it's a good question, John. I'll toss that first to Jeannie Birch and then to Chris Lim.
Well, the first thing you have to do is have a variety of housing types. You need to have apartments of varying size. You need to have townhomes. You need to have single-family homes that are built close together, so that you need to have choice and varying price points. Then we have within our own system ways of subsidizing affordable workforce housing. The most important device, of course, is the low-income housing tax credit, which does provide support for rental housing. And finally, we have ways of innovating through technology and modern building materials in ways to bring the cost of housing down. Mm-hmm. That, of course, touches upon building codes and what you have to do in talking to your communities about allowing for changes in building codes to occur, which is almost as difficult as getting a zoning change.
And Chris, you talk about in your book about new urbanism that the biggest negative is the lack of affordable housing.
Exactly. That is the major unintended consequence. And again, it goes back to the fact that there's a supply problem, that the governments, local governments, have said that you cannot build this, and therefore the places that do allow it go up in value. That's, you know, basic Adam Smith 101. Mm-hmm. Number of ways that we can get around it, but it needs to be a conscious strategy. Right now, our affordable housing strategy in this country is you drive until you qualify. So you just have to drive another 30 minutes each way, and you'll find something to buy, which obviously is highly unsustainable and not particularly fair to poorer folk.
Sure.
The main way that we pay for it is that if you can drop one car out of your household, if your typical household has two or three cars in it, you drop one of them out. According to the AAA, we spend $7,000 per year to own and operate a car. If you convert that into a mortgage, believe it or not, you can qualify for an additional $120,000 worth of mortgage. So what this is shifting households, household income, from a depreciable asset, a car, into a appreciable asset, and then you walk to work and you get healthier. So that's one. Two is inclusionary zoning. So inclusionary zoning is where you say that that all development, and this should not just be walkable urban, this is throughout the entire region, should have at least 20% affordable housing built in, and that's of course defined in the regulation. So that's an easy thing to do. But finally, something far more complex is that we know where price appreciation is going to take place, and it's where walkable urbanism is allowed. If we know that, we can find ways to participate in the land value increases that are going to take place around these walkable urban, say, rail stations. I mean, if we know what's going to happen in the future as far as prices going up, and we can't find a way to tap into that, shame on us.
Well, we're already doing it with tax financing, and it would just be a matter of directing that financing in the ways that we want to support the kind of housing, if it's inclusionary housing or whatever.
Perfect.
But I'm thinking what seems to happen today. And I'm thinking of certain neighbors in Philadelphia that were low-income neighborhoods. They get gentrified, the prices go up, and the poor people that live there, if they were renters, they move out or they can't afford the higher taxes, and you create these little islands of affluence. But you've got a city like Philadelphia where 25% of the population lives below the poverty line.
Well, you've got to be proactive. You've got to be proactive as you're thinking about the various changes you're making to incent the kind of development we're talking about, and you need to include consideration of means to assure that there will be a certain percentage of affordable housing in whatever is built or reconditioned. Also, in places like Philadelphia, there are tax programs that protect the homeowner that the city's put in place, so that if you can't afford to pay your taxes now while you're alive, it goes to your estate. You know, there are all sorts of ways to deal with this so that you don't have to penalize or reduce affordable housing.
And Chris, do people want to live in, if not integrated neighborhoods, at least economically diverse neighborhoods?
You know, we've been doing it for, 5,500 years. Since we've been building cities, they have been income integrated. In 1960, I looked at a census block in South Philly, and in today's dollars, in that census tract, people were making $10,000 per year, and people were making $1 million per year, all living within walking distance of one another. Mm-hmm. That's how we've been building our cities for up until suburban sprawl, and suburban sprawl is income segregated. It is, you know, people think that it would be a disaster if somebody who made a little bit less money than they did moved next door.
In a smaller unit.
Right. But because people see their house as this, you know, their main asset, and that's where their equity is.
Well, and I live on a block in D.C. here that, you know, reasonably high-end townhouses next to rental apartments that rent to various interns next to homeless housing. And that's what you move here for, is for that diversity and that, you know, it is not homogeneous. That's why we're here.
Let me get to Katie from Ambler to join us. Hi, Katie. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
This is such a great topic. My husband and I both used to live in Philadelphia, and we live in Ambler now. And I really feel like we kind of have the best of both worlds. We have an older house with a big backyard, but we're still able to walk into town to, you know, go to the grocery store or the post office. And I just am surprised that, like, the neighbors that we have, and there's a lot of big developments, that people just aren't interested in walking. Like, I mean, I know you made a comment that a lot of people want that, but, I mean, we have a family, and I feel like that's important for my kids to be able to, you know, walk someplace to get ice cream, but none of our friends really do that. They all get in their cars and drive, and so I kind of feel bad that it's like that. Not more people seem to, at least where we live, seem to want that.
Well, that's interesting, Katie. I'm going to toss it over to Jeannie Birch.
Well, this is you can see that this topic is much bigger than talking about urban planning. It's really a public health issue. Mm-hmm. And if we were to look at the data on obesity in the United States today, we would be horrified. I don't think you have to look at the data. You just have to look around.
Exactly.
And we are faced again with a big educational program to let people know that they better get out and walk because they're not going to live very long.
Right, because we now know that 40-50% of this obesity epidemic is due to drivable suburban lifestyle.
Is that right?
And I grew up in Drexel Hill, right outside the city, went to public school there for 12 years, and I calculated once on the back of an envelope that I walked 2,200 miles in my 12 years going up to Upper Darby High School. And right now, most of our drivable suburban communities, it's illegal to walk to school. They don't want the legal liability. You must be bused.
We also have issues about how schools are planned. You have to have multiple acres around these schools, which means they have to be at distances from where people live. So, as we said, this is a bigger problem than just looking at a few housing units.
So, Krista, you lord it over your kids. You say, when I was a young, when I was a student, I worked 2,200 miles to school.
Exactly. And that
sounds
and
like
that
Abraham Lincoln.
Uphill.
Reading
and I
by
walk
candlelight.
Uphill both ways.
but I think Katie's point is an important one in that even people that maybe live in these towns that we've been talking about don't take advantage of what that town has to offer.
Sure, it's a habit.
It's
part of its habit, but also if that town had more there, there'd be more reason to walk there, and people will begin to get into the habit, and they'll find that they'll meet their neighbors more on the street, and that it becomes part of their social life.
And Katie, where are they driving to? They're not driving to the downtown ice cream store, aren't they driving out to the mall?
I don't know if we still have Katie or
not. Or we lose Katie.
But there's probably some truth to that, which is because the way malls are built, they tend to be within 15 to 20 minutes.
Right.
Katie, thanks for the call. Let me get Andy from Doylestown to join us. Andy, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's a very good subject. My point is that as long as gasoline is $3 a gallon, there is no way that you're going to stop what's happening now. Because unless you raise like a gas tax, make it revenue neutral, you're just going to have everybody driving around in an SUV, la-di-da, and the traffic just keeps getting worse and worse. And it's crazy. I mean, I just saw a woman walking her kid down 611 in Warrington, heading towards Doylestown, getting blown away by the cars, you know, driving past her. There's not even sidewalks. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, Andy, let me toss your comment over to Chris Leinberger. And I wonder, I mean, people are complaining because gas is $3 or $3.50 a gallon. Do you agree with Andy? You got to up it even more to make this happen and change people's behavior?
Well, ideally, we would put on that gas tax, and it would be put on gradually. That's not going to happen. But what will happen is that the price of gas will continue to go up, and rather than we spending that money in this country, we're going to give it to Saudi Arabia to spend it there, because it is probable, not definite, but it's probable that we are approaching what's known as peak oil, where the amount of supply worldwide will begin to top out and begin to decline. We in this country hit peak oil in 1970. 40 countries have already hit peak oil, and there's a good chance that and a lot of discussion going on, of course, in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere about, you know, are we at peak oil? So in all probability, $90 a barrel gasoline or oil and $3 a gallon gasoline is going to look cheap in the future. It's just that we're probably going to give that money to Russia and to Saudi Arabia rather than giving it to ourselves and investing it in rail transit.
Can you want to add to
well,
that?
Well, just also, I would reiterate that it is history because look at China and India. They're using fractions of the amount that they have the potential to use, and so the market is going to tell us.
Well, I mean, do you see then that there is this kind of groundswell? I'm looking at you, Jeannie, to really move ahead on some of these development ideas we've been talking about.
No, there's no groundswell. There's denial.
We're all
in denial, which is every time gasoline goes up 2 cents, we hear the politicians screaming. No one has any backbone to say, look, this is the future. We need to make some changes.
Mm-hmm. So you need politicians to
lead
the way?
We need leadership, but we also need the nation to give them some backbone. And we have an election coming up.
Yes, we do. Chris, I mean, I don't hear the candidates talking about this.
No.
Not yet, anyway.
No, they aren't. And obviously the candidates aren't talking about much as far as issues in general. It's more tone. But they will be dealing with it. Of course, here at Brookings, we're focusing very much on 2009, because with a new president, a new administration, there's going to be a lot of issues. And the big issue in 2009 is the transportation bill, what's referred to as T4, which is the largest discretionary domestic spending bill. It's basically where gas taxes go.
Right.
And that gets debated in 2009, and that's where if you'll excuse the pun, the rubber will meet the road.
Mm. and whether it goes to roads or whether it goes to public transit or, I guess, infrastructure as well.
That's the issue.
Let me get one more caller on before we have to say goodbye, and this is Seth from Philadelphia. Seth, go ahead, your Radio Times.
I just had a comment about a place I travel in the world.
Sure.
I was thinking of Hong Kong and the Kowloon neighborhood, where at night they actually close off a lot of the side streets and then become pedestrian ways. And it's great for business. Families walk around. It's very safe. People are walking around until 10 o'clock at night. We could do the same thing in Philadelphia on South Street where you close it down. You could rent out revenue space to stores, restaurants, cafes, and do like a pedestrian walkway. And that was just one idea that I think Philadelphia could use from other cities.
That's a wonderful idea.
I appreciate the call. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a wonderful idea, how we can make places interesting and vibrant and get people out. Mm. Other cities, for example, Providence, what they did something called daylighted their river, and they made that the centerpiece of activity, and they have something called water fire once a month, and people come and look at the fire burning in the river, and they go out to hear music and all sorts of things happening. So you're absolutely right about, and it's not just Philadelphia that needs to make itself interesting. It's all these wonderful small towns that we have scattered throughout the United States.
And in fact, you have a great example of what Jeannie's referring to, you know, festivals and great management. The Center City District in downtown Philadelphia, led by Paul Levy, is one of the top three, in my mind, downtown management efforts that make the downtown special, that put on festivals, that keep it clean and safe. And they're also, by the way, getting into improving the public schools serving Center City. So those kinds of operations are crucial, and you know, they could close off South Street on occasion. I would urge not to do it permanently because we don't yet have the density. In Europe, many streets can get closed off because they have the density and they have much better rail transit. But it all comes down to management, and you've got one of the best models in the country in Center City District.
I couldn't agree more. And the other thing to think about are other systems of mobility, like bike trails and other ways to move around the city.
Well, much more to talk about, but I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Christopher Limeburger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jeannie Birch, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And I should say, Chris's book is called The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. And Jeannie Birch has got a book coming out later this year called Growing Greener Cities. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and find out about podcasts and leave us an email as well. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.